We looked at Wycliffe of England, a pre-reformer. We're going to look at the man we always think of along with Wycliffe, John Huss of Bohemia. Bohemia is an ancient name for what is coextensive generally so with modern Czechoslovakia. I'll give you the years, 1370 to 1415. And you see many parallels, just as Wycliffe was a teacher at Oxford. John Huss was a teacher at the University of Prague, and the king of Bohemia was very proud of his university. He became a disciple of Wycliffe through the writings of Wycliffe. I indicate here, the king of England had married a Bohemian princess, and when she was in England, she came into contact with the work of Wycliffe and brought some of the material to Bohemia, and Huss picked up on it. He became a national hero because he had stood for the rights of Bohemians against the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. Here you see this as a part of rising nationalism, and you see a parallel of sorts, do you not? Wycliffe was also in the good graces of the state, of the king. He was excommunicated for circulating the teachings of Huss, but he was so very popular that the church was forced to reinstate him. But then they excommunicated him a second time because he wouldn't keep his mouth shut. He opposed one of the papal crusades, we'll go into that, and that wasn't very popular. And he attacked the idea of the indulgences. You recall that full indulgence was offered, that if you went on a crusade and died on a crusade, it was just about the same thing as a sainthood. You could escape purgatory, and he blasted that. The Council of Constance, we keep coming back to this very important council. You recall this is the one that burnt Wycliffe posthumously. And, it summoned him to, because he was so important, summoned him to answer charges, and it offered him a safe conduct. That is, he would, we're going to see this later, and Martin Luther's offered the same thing. He learned from Huss's experience, because as soon as Huss showed up, they immediately arrested him. And they'll water the safe conduct. Well, they said a promise made to a heretic is not binding. And so the church leaders put him in prison, kept him incommunicado. This was part of the Inquisition, really, system. You know, they put a man in prison and starve him and freeze him for a long time. They did this to Huss and didn't do any good. He's finally brought before the council. He's not allowed to speak. He simply was called upon to repudiate his writings. And we're going to see this again with Martin Luther. His defense was, did you or did you not write these? Do you repudiate them? The question was not whether they were heretical or not. And interestingly enough, and we're going to see this also with Martin Luther next quarter, that much of what Huss was saying was heretical in terms of what the Roman Catholic Church was teaching and practicing. It was not heretical technically, in terms of dogma. Got that? So a lot of these things that they were, remember I already taught you that a lot of these things that the pre-reformers and the reformers objected to were really dogmatized after the Reformation in response to them. And this is one of the reasons they didn't want to get into a debate with Huss, arguing theology, because it wasn't all that clear. Say, well, you're a heretic. And you say, you show me in the book, chapter, and verse where I'm a heretic. And they had a real hard time doing that. For instance, papal, you show me a book, chapter, and verse where I'm a heretic when I deny papal infallibility. When did papal infallibility get into the book? 1870. It was 400 years, you see. And does this help us understand why they weren't interested in getting into a debate? That's not the only reason. Well, the council burned his writings and burned him. And just as The ashes of Wycliffe were thrown into the River Swift, the ashes of Huss were thrown into the Rhine. That is, they could not be buried in sacred ground. He couldn't go to heaven. He certainly wasn't going to. His body remain in the church's cemetery. But a movement was underway called the Bohemian Brethren, and they continued underground. A crusade was called to root them out, did not do it successfully, and we're going to meet them again later. The Bohemian Brethren were the followers of John Huss, a pre-reformer. You always think of Wycliffe and Huss together, and they were connected, and Huss was convinced by the writings of Wycliffe. We come now to a a moral reformer, not a doctrinal reformer, so he's a pre-reformer. Savonarola, 1452 to 1498, quite a character. Girolamo Savonarola, he's in Florence, Italy. This is a very wealthy and immoral city. And I've already pointed out in this age the church was no better than society. Sometimes it was worse, especially in northern Italy. And he is a very sensitive young man. He entered a monastery, as I point out, when a girl refused to marry him. And he became a preaching monk. And he was a great preacher. He would enter the pulpit with a cross in one hand and a whip in the other and hold up the cross and snap the whip and repent, you know, and he is best show in town. He wasn't for reforming any doctrines. He wasn't against indulgences or anything like that. He just was for morality. And for a while it caught on, kind of a surface kind of revival, as this kind of preaching sometimes produces. He led a book burning, condemned what he called vanities. Vanities were a luxurious dress and all kinds of extravagances. He openly criticized Alexander VI for his morals. Remember, Alexander VI was the worst of all the popes. He was the Borgia Pope. Where I looked, it never got any worse than Alexander VI. And so if Savonarola wanted to criticize him, he had plenty of raw material. And the crowds came to hear him preach and produce, as I've said, a genuine, brief revival. However, the crowds were fickle. It was not a doctrinal revival. Everything was pretty much on the surface. And when the church excommunicated him, Alexander excommunicated him, and put a ban on the city of Florence. That is, they forbade the people to come and hear him. And the people eventually turned against him. Many were jealous of his popularity. He was very popular, had great crowds. But many got tired of his puritanical attitude. This thing of living this clean life, this straight life, was very radical in those days. It was sort of a fad. It is with some people, you know. And revival, it wore off. One thing to live a straight life for a few weeks, but to really make that the way you live, especially in a society that was going the other way, they turned against, but the fickle crowd turned against him, and he called for a trial by fire to prove that God was with him, which wasn't very smart. Trial by fire was, the old theory, similar to the theory of punishment, that is, trial by torture, that courage gave you strength to withstand. Well, if you were right, according to the theory of trial by fire, if you were right, you wouldn't burn. And so it was quite a thing. I point out it was eventually rain. What happened was, this is in Florence, and it was a big show. People loved things like this. Great preparations were made. Two piers of thorns, of thorn and other wood, were built along the public square, 60 feet long, 3 feet wide at the base, and 4 feet high. It's like a hallway, 60 feet long, 4 feet high, and 3 feet wide, two on either side, and just a narrow walkway in between, just a few feet in between. So you walk literally through between two walls of fire. And the square was closed. The people began to ride the night before, like a rock concert. Make sure they got a good seat. You could scalpers' prices for a seat at the windows. They were going to see this man walk through the fire. Florence, this is a very immoral, stupid age, and they were going to watch him see if he burned or not, see who was right, Alexander or Savonarola. It was set for 11 o'clock. They lit the fire. The Dominicans were in charge of this. However, Savonarola was a Franciscan, and it became something of a party fight as well as a test by fire. And one of the Dominican leaders, one of the Franciscan leaders, Fra Domenico, he was his clergyman, and he was dressed in a fiery red cape and his whole ceremony regalia, and Savonarola was dressed in white, and Savonarola had the host in his head, had a cup with the Lord's Supper. He's going to carry that with him through the fire. When the hour arrived and the fire was lit, Savonarola decided to preach, and he did. He couldn't stop him, you know, his last words. And so he He said it was like Mount Carmel in reverse. You know, the fire came and destroyed the sacrifice, and the fire was going to be withheld. And he's preaching, and the fire is burning, and he's preaching, and the fire is burning. Well, I finally got ready, so that's enough preaching. Let's go down and do it. Well, then they got held up. They started to walk through, and the Franciscans refused to let they got a big brouhaha about the cape that Frau Domenico was wearing. They got whether it should be brought that close to the fire, and I said that Savonarola was a Franciscan, was the other way around. He was a Dominican. It was the Franciscans who were the opposing party. But anyway, the Franciscan said that this Domenico shouldn't wear his capes because they were sacred garments and they would protect them, and so that they would be spared on behalf of the garments, not because of the man in them. So they had to change clothes, and the fire is burning. And then they said he shouldn't carry the cross, because the cross might protect him, and to be spared on, so they couldn't carry that, and the fire is burning. And then they said Savonarola shouldn't carry the host, the communion with him in the cup, and they'll head the loaf too in a little container. And they got in a big argument over that, and the Dominicans and the Franciscans are fighting. And so finally Savonarola said that the signatory was, he declared that the accidents might be burned like a husk, but the essence would remain unconsumed. Remember this transubstantiation? Might burn up the wine and the loaf, it wouldn't burn up the essence of it. And so then they argued over that for a while, and the fire's burning, and it started raining. And put out the fire. Well, and everybody got mad. Nightfall, they came to see somebody get burned, and they missed it, It's all these delays, and then it got rained on, and the fire was out, and the people really were mad. They turned against him bitterly, because he'd robbed them of a show. Some had been there all night. You can see their point of view. And so he was tortured with the strapados, that is, he was submitted to the Inquisition. In his delirium, he admitted to certain charges. They strangled him because he confessed to heresy, whatever it was. That was if you confessed, they would strangle you before they burned you, so you would be dead he was burned at a stake, but he was already dead because they had strangled him because he did confess. Well, it's a window to the age, isn't it? Savonarola, preaching moral reform, indicates the kind of age in which they live. I want to say a word about the Renaissance. Renaissance means new birth or renewal. It was the intellectual transition from the medieval to the modern world. In the narrowest sense, it was a literary movement. It was a renewal of interest in the classical literature of Greece and Rome and early Christian literature. And you know about the Renaissance, do you not? The new rebirth of learning went back to the end of the Dark Ages. The background, and this is very brief, was the emergence of cities, nations, growth, commerce, trade, a general broadening of the intellectual horizons. We've already talked about how the Crusades contributed to this. The world is opening up again. This is the age of Christopher Columbus and the Spanish and Portuguese explorers. This is the age of the rediscovery of literature, of learning, as we've already said. Also, with the emergence of cities and states and commerce and trade and learning, there was a general rejection of Christianity, organized Christianity. And why not? You look at Alexander VI, men like him. That's Christianity, forget it. And many did. Now, the Renaissance represents a shift from a theological view of things to a naturalistic or humanistic view. Earth began to be viewed as something more than heaven's proving ground. You had to have men like Petrarch, who would, first man supposedly climbed a mountain for the view. You begin to have landscapes appear in art. The world begins to be appreciated for itself. Other than the world is something more than just the welcome mat to heaven, or the doorstep to heaven. You see that? There was the Well, the world is important, and you should study this in the history of philosophy. I'm sure you do. The Renaissance began in northern Italy. The representatives, the famous Florentine trio we talk about, Dante, Petrarch, and Boccaccio. Boccaccio was the one who opened the treasures of Greek literature. He also wrote racy literature, which is still read in modern translations. Interesting, he wrote some real good scholarly stuff. He also wrote some semi-pornography, and that was, guess which is read more. The Decameron, these 100 stories, kind of racy literature, but it was a racy age. It was not high morals. Mirandola delved into Hebrew literature, for example. He was not satisfied with the Latin translation of the Old Testament that is in the Vulgate. Lorenzo Valla, called the father of historical criticism, he called for a return to the primary sources. By the way, the view that the church had of the scriptures, what little use they had of the scriptures, was they viewed the Vulgate the same way that a lot of churches today view the King James. They sanctified a translation. I heard on the way to work this morning, I heard a Baptist church advertise itself, said, "We are faithful to the King James Bible," which is, you know, it's very strange. Here you have a bunch of Baptists who are faithful to a fairly good English translation by a bunch of Episcopalian priests. Anyway, the idea was that the Vulgate was somehow, even though it was a translation, was the authority. And it seems very simple to us, you see, to go back on any translation to the Greek text. That sounds very simple, to say that the Greek text has precedence over any translation of it, right? But when he said this, it was very radical. The idea of correcting the Vulgate. Oh, no, the Vulgate is sacred. It had a sort of superstitious view of the Vulgate. It was he who proved that the Donation of Constantine was a forgery. He proved that the Apostles' Creed could not have been written by the apostles. Pretty good scholarship, isn't it? He compared the Vulgate with the Greek text, and we already talked about that. So you have the rise of learning. What were the fruits of the Italian Renaissance? Well, first of all, the beginnings of modern literature. The beginnings of modern literature. The beginnings of modern art. And you've already know something about this, do you not, from Professor Chambers' class, the development in art. You begin to have portraits and begin to have naturalism and realism in art, and it's a very important and interesting topic. We should have more time to spend on it. A revival of scholarship, we already mentioned this, had the rise of humanism. Man begins to be said that man is the measure of all things, that man has autonomous value. It is man, not God, who is important. Humanism, secular humanism. And as you might expect, there was a decline of morals, if that was possible. You wouldn't think that anything could get worse, but it did. The only thing that get worse, that is, when they threw out, note this, it's the same thing we've seen in America, only starting at a lower level. That is, one of the reasons why almost half of all babies now are born out of wedlock, why venereal disease is epidemic in America, divorce, juvenile delinquency. Why is it? Is there any connection between that and the humanism that's taught in the colleges and the high schools? Of course there's a connection. You teach man that he's an animal, and that there are no moral absolutes, that you make up your own values, that man is the measure of all things. Will it not trickle down and have an effect on how people actually live? Well, of course it does. Now, and this happened in Europe, especially, it started in northern Italy, but you see, they were already low when they started. Remember we talked about how the church would work to raise the morals, and that was one of your test questions, all the things the church did to try to raise the moral life and the intellectual life of the world. So it was, and when you even took that away, it's like digging down from the cellar. Burckhardt, the man who coined the word Renaissance, by the way, an early historian, very great historian, he's the one who identified the Renaissance as a particular period in history, wrote this: "Nevertheless, it cannot be denied that Italy, at the beginning of the 16th century, found itself in the midst of a grave moral crisis out of which the best men saw hardly any escape." Religion was paganized. Christ was not forgotten, but Pan was more enthusiastically honored. Talk about the Renaissance popes. What you must see is that to make things utterly worse, that the Renaissance popes were a part of the problem, not a part of the solution. They overthrew the old moral standards of the church. The church jumped in the mud hole with everybody else. Schaff writes at this period, and this is not in your syllabus, intellectual freedom in Italy assumed the form of unrestrained indulgence of the sensual nature. In condemning the virginity extolled by the church, Beccadelli pronounced it a sin against nature. Nature is good. And he urged men to break down the law by mixing with nuns. Not very modern, doesn't it? You know, it's not like the 60s. You know, sex is good, but if it feels good, do it, is what he was saying. The hetairai were of greater service, those were prostitutes, to mankind than monastic recluses. A prostitute does more good than a monk. That's a pretty radical idea, isn't it? Illegitimacy, as has already been said, was no bar to high position in the state of the church. Aeneas Sylvius declared that most of the rulers in Italy had been born out of wedlock. And when, as Pope, he arrived in Ferrara in 1459, he was met by 8 princes, not a single one of them the child of a legitimate marriage. The appearance of the Gallic disease, that's gonorrhea, syphilis, call it the Gallic disease. Remember, southern France was a little bit heavier. Always started there. It's one of the great things that France has given to the world, I mean to the Western world, syphilis and wine. The appearance of the Gallic disease in Italy at the close of the 15th century may have made men cautious. That is, by the way, in this period, a syphilis spread all over Europe. It came, by the way, from the east, from the Far East, originally. It came into northern Italy on shipboard, probably. May have made men cautious. The rumor went that Julius, anyway, even one of the popes had it. Aretino wrote that the times were so debauched that cousins and kinsfolk of both sexes, brothers and sisters, mingled together without number and without a shadow of conscientious scruple. What else could be expected than the poisoning of all grades of society when, at the central court of Christendom, the fountain was so corrupt? The revels in the Vatican under Alexander VI and the levity of the court under Leo X. Now, Leo was the pope who got after Martin Luther. Furnished a spectacle which the most virtuous principles could scarcely be expected to resist. Did not a harlequin monk on one occasion furnish the mirth at Leo's table by his extravagant veracity in swallowing a pigeon whole and consuming 40 eggs and 20 capons in succession? A capon's a young hen. How many eggs all that? So this was the entertainment. Watch this monk eat enormous amounts of food. Innocent VIII's son was married to a daughter of the House of Medici, and Alexander's son was married to the royal family of France, and his daughter Lucrezia Borgia, the famous or evil woman, into the scarcely less proud family of Este. Sixtus IV taxed and thereby legalized houses of prostitution for the increase of revenues in the curia. How do you like that? The papacy taxing the houses of prostitution. The 6,800 public prostitutes in Rome in 1490, we accept as certain Serrera's figures, were an enormous number in proportion to the population. That is, 6,800 prostitutes, and Rome didn't have that many people in it. It was very close to being a fourth of the population, possibly, or even. And see, their pilgrims would come from all over the world to Rome, make their pilgrimage, and the prostitutes were there to serve them. The Roman dyer says that scarcely a priest was to be found in Rome who did not keep a concubine for the glory of God and the Christian religion. All parts of Italy and Spain contribute to the number of courtesans. Those were kept women, mistresses. They lived in greater splendor in Rome than the hetairai in Athens. The hetairai were the high-class prostitutes in ancient Athens, and bore classical names such as Diana, Lucrezia, Camellia, and it lists a bunch of others. They were accompanied in their promenades and walks to church by the poets, counts, and prelates, and usually concluded their gilded misery in hospitals after their beauty had faded away. So it usually came to no good. When their beauty was gone, they they were diseased and died alone. The almost nameless vice of the ancient world was found its way into Italy, and humanists and sons and popes, like the son of Paul III, and he named some others, if not the popes themselves, were charged with pederasty. Pederasty is homosexuality. Pederasty is the love between an adult man and a young boy. And it was the Greeks were known for it. The gymnasiums were centers of pederasty. In classical Greece, it was just sort of a way of life. And he says that's why he talked about this almost nameless, that is so shameful it's hard to name it, the vice of the ancient classical world, found it, and he says it was practiced in the papacy itself. In the seventh satire, Ariosto, who died in 1533, went so far as to say it was the vice of almost all the humanists. Great decline. In other words, you can see why Burckhardt said that the Northern Italy found itself in the midst of a grave moral crisis, out of which the best men saw hardly any escape. I always laugh when people say, "Boy, things are." There's a song about has a popular song ballad sings to Jesus, telling Jesus that things are worse now than they've ever been. Things have never been this bad. Anybody ever says that, they just don't know their history. Things have been worse even in America, morally. Yeah, that's right. But things have been worse in the past than they are now. And the worse then. It's hard to believe. Well, we look at the Renaissance north of the Alps as we come to our last discussion. The Renaissance up in the Holy Roman Empire. We look at the Renaissance in northern Italy. But the Renaissance north of the Alps was less humanistic, more religious. In Italy, the Renaissance existed among coteries or academies of scholars. Its spirit never got out into the masses or to the universities. It was an elitist movement. North of the Alps, it was more democratic and was active in the universities, more of a scholarly thing. The greatest representative of the Renaissance north of the Alps was one of my friend and yours, Erasmus of Rotterdam. By the way, Erasmus, although we don't agree with everything he said, of course, was closer than any of the major intellectual figures of this period to New Testament Christianity. But it was Erasmus who put together the Greek text, which is the basis of the King James translation, by the way. Erasmus, he was born in Rotterdam. He was the illegitimate son of a priest, but again, that put him in the majority. What happened, he was raised in a monastery under the Brethren of the Common Life. Remember them, the mystics? Emphasized the learning and piety and mysticism. It's very common. If a priest had an illegitimate son, he would provide for him, put him in the school. And he owed a great debt to them. His abbot recognized his intellectual superiority, allowed him to go to the university, and he never got him back. So he had taken a vow, a monastic vow, which was a sort of a modified ascetic thing. But once he was gone and went to the university, he never came back to the monastery. He was to become an international figure. He was well known in England, France, Switzerland. Never before or since has the whole of Europe so read after one man. He was a genuine celebrity. One of the reasons that the church couldn't put him to death was, they'd like to get rid of him, was because he was so popular. That wasn't the only reason. And now keep in mind that he was an international figure, but nations were not as important then as they are now. It was very common for people to think of themselves in less nationalistic terms. He was not an Orthodox Catholic, nor was he a Protestant. He held for primitive Christianity. But the reason, that is, he held for a return to the New Testament. And to show this, he went back and restored the Greek text, which shows he was pretty serious, doesn't it? But as in the case of the mystics, and here you see his mystical training, He, even though he was more radical in his reforming views than Martin Luther was, he was never declared a heretic because he did not attack the sacraments as Luther did. We're going to see he did what? He ignored them. That is, that means he didn't, he availed himself of the sacraments. He went through the whole sacramental ritual. He just didn't take them seriously. He said, well, nothing. No, in other words, his point was, his position was, no harm done. And so he focused upon the moral teachings of Jesus. I discuss here the influence of Erasmus on the Protestant Reformation. And by the way, in all these things, you see, we've looked at things negative, things positive that lead up to the Reformation. We see a great need for reform, do we not? Doctrinal, moral, intellectual reform, administrative reform, all kinds of reform. And we see glimmers of light. We see Wycliffe and Huss who sow seed that's going to bear fruit later. And another one whose thought, even though he was never a Protestant, whose thought had more influence than the writings of Wycliffe and Huss toward promoting the intellectual climate for reform was Erasmus. He popularized criticism of the Roman Catholic system. One of the reasons it was so popular when Luther started criticizing the system, why he had such a following was that Huss and Wycliffe and even more Erasmus, see, Huss and Wycliffe were heretics, right? Their influence was hurt by the fact that they were burned. Erasmus was a hero. The Pope loved him. He walked a narrow line. Later on, we're going to see that Luther called for it, said to Erasmus, and Luther went back and restored Augustinian theology, which is not consistent. We'll talk about this in theology class. We will next quarter, too. But Augustinian theology is contradictory. And Luther one time wrote Erasmus and called for him and said, come and stand for and die with me. And Erasmus wrote back and said that he was perfectly willing to die for Christ, but he was not willing to die for the contradictions of Martin Luther. Interesting. He would die for Christ, but not for Augustinian theology, which is quite perceptive. He pointed out, and it was he who wrote on the freedom of the will, and Luther wrote his famous Bondage of the Will against Erasmus. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. He popularized criticism of the Roman Catholic system. Let me give you a sample. Now, note this. He does not say, do away with the sacraments. He simply says, it's not either or. With Luther, it was either or, so he was a heretic. With Huss and Wycliffe, it was either or. Either Christ or ex opere operato and the whole rotten system. But with Erasmus, said both and. Listen to this. Of what use is it to be sprinkled on the outside by holy water, if filthy within? This is Erasmus writing. So he didn't say don't use holy water, but just what good is it if you're not holy within? Notice, that's a mystic talking. So this is training in the brethren of the common life. No devotion better pleases Mary than the imitation of her humility. You want to worship Mary? How about imitating her? It's quite perceptive, isn't it? Would you please, Peter and Paul, then emulate the faith of the one and the charity of the other? Thereby you will do better than if you make 10 pilgrimages to Rome. Would you imitate St. Francis? As it is, you are arrogant, avaricious, and contentious. We're talking about the Franciscans who had become just that. Control your temper. Despise lucre. Overcome evil with good. You think it important to be buried in the cowl of a Franciscan? You know what that means? You recall my discussion of that? The superstition that if you're buried in a monk's cowl, you could slip by purgatory. You want to be to put on his habit after you are dead will profit you nothing if you have not put on his deportment while alive. You get that? It's either or. He doesn't say it's a silly superstition, don't do it. He simply says it's going good to do it if you have not lived like a monk while you're alive. I do not condemn you for revering the ashes of Paul. Homage paid to the relics. I do not condemn that. But if you venerate mute, lifeless ashes while neglecting his living image, speaking, as it were, breathing in his letters, is not your devotion preposterous? He says, if you want to pay homage to the ashes of Paul, fine. But while you're doing that, doesn't it make sense to, if you're going to honor his ashes, to obey what he wrote? You make much of a fragment of his body encased in glass, but do you admire the whole mind of Paul shining through his epistles? You honor a statue of Christ in wood or stone and adorned with colors. You would do better to honor the image of his mind, which through the Holy Spirit is expressed in the Gospels. Are you excited over the seamless robe and the napkin of Christ and yet doze over the oracles of his law? The napkin was the St. Veronica had the, you know, wiped his face on the Via Dolorosa, and it's probably what it refers to. It may refer to the shroud. Can't be sure. Far better that you should believe than that you should treasure at home a piece of the wood of the cross. Otherwise, you are no better than Judas, who with his lips touched the divine mouth. See, you honor the relics, we don't honor what Christ said. The physical presence of Christ is useless. What's he talking about? The physical presence of Christ. Transubstantiation. See, Luther denied transubstantiation. And we're going to see later he was inconsistent. His substitution was about the same thing. But the point is, he doesn't deny it, he simply says the physical presence of Christ is useless for salvation. Did not Paul say, if I had known Christ after the flesh, I will know him no longer? When I talk in this fashion, I am supposed to be recommending the abolition of all external ceremonies, all the devotions of the simple, especially those approved by the authority of the church. Am I saying, whenever I say this, I'm accused of saying, do away with the sacraments? No, he says. They are sometimes aids to piety and practically necessary for babes in Christ, but the salt has lost its savor. What good is it? I am ashamed to speak of all the superstitions attached to these ceremonies. Ask Luther, are you going to do away with the sacraments? Yes. Erasmus, you going to do away with them? No. But Erasmus was just as critical of them as Luther. And his criticisms were more deadly because he was not a heretic. And by the way, listen to me, he was not violating the official Roman Catholic position in this. He was violating what they were teaching and what was being done. Do you see that distinction? You see how he got away with it? Well, one of the many reasons the Protestant Reformation could work was that Erasmus undermined the confidence people had in the sacraments. He used wit. By the way, it's a deadly weapon, wit. But he never went so far as to become a heretic. Where Luther battered down, Erasmus undermined. That's a good way to think of it. You get that? Where Luther would, with a frontal assault, would batter it down, Erasmus undermined from within. And such works as the In Praise of Folly, and Folly was a silly woman who became Erasmus' mouthpiece, he reduced the spirit of all in regard to sacraments and sacramentals. Remember what they are. That is, how did he get away with it? He got away with saying things. He'd write this, it was fiction, and Folly was a silly woman, and he'd have her say all kinds of perceptive things. But if anybody'd say, you would believe, no, this is just a fictional case. This is just fiction. This is just folly talking. What do you expect of her? She's a silly woman. But the point is, he made his point. And you remember, in Praise of Folly. So here's Folly speaking, okay? This is Erasmus' mouthpiece. And so Erasmus, he's himself off the hook by using a puppet, using a mannequin, a mouthpiece. And what shall I say of those who comfortably delude themselves with imaginary pardons for their sins, who measure the time in purgatory with an hourglass into years, months, days, hours, with all the precision of a mathematical table. Follow me? One, so much money is worth exactly so much time in purgatory. There are plenty, too, who, relying upon certain magical little certificates and prayers, those were indulgences, which some pious impostor devised either in fun or for the benefit of his pocket, believe that they may procure riches, honor, future happiness, health, and perpetual prosperity, long life, and a lusty old age, nay, in the end, a seat at the right hand of Christ in heaven. But as for this last, it matters not how long it be deferred. They will content themselves with the joys of heaven only when they must finally surrender the pleasures of this world to which they lovingly cling. Talk about the clergy who were living in splendor and wealth, talking about He said he noticed they talk about the glories of life with Christ, but they were pretty much attached to this world, which they were.
The traitor, the soldier, and the judge that... I got a misprint error. Didn't copy it. The judge, something like that. They can clean up the Aegean stables in a lifetime. Oh, they think. The traitor, the soldier, the judge, they think that they can clean up the Aegean stables of a lifetime once for all by sacrificing a single coin of their ill-gotten gains. See, he's attacking indulgences here again. You see that? What's the Aegean stables? The Aegean stables of a lifetime. Remember, they hadn't been cleaned in many years, one of the labors of Hercules, to clean the Aegean. Here's a man whose life is rotten. So he thinks he can pay for all this by a single coin of his ill-gotten gains. They flatter themselves that all sorts of perjury, debauchery, drunkenness, quarrels, bloodshed, imposture, perfidy, that's deceit, and treason can be compounded for by contract, and so adjusted that having paid off all their arrears, they can begin with a new score. You know, do anything you want to. Lie, murder, cheat, steal, then just pay so much money, and everything's okay. Now, note this. The Roman Catholic Church did not officially teach, did not make that dogma, never have. But were they using that system? Were they teaching it? The answer is yes, exactly what they were teaching. How foolish, or rather, how happy are those who promise themselves more than supernal happiness if they repeat the verses of the seven holy psalms. Those magical lines are supposed to have been taught to St. Bernard by a demon who seems to have been a wag, but he was not very clever, and poor fellow was frustrated in his attempt to deceive the saint. These silly things, which even I, folly, and am almost ashamed of, are approved not only by the common, but even by the teachers of religion. You know, that's deadly, isn't it? See what Erasmus has folly saying? Well, I'm just a silly woman. I'm just a foolish girl. Yet, I got more sense than that. You see how this would not undermine the confidence people had in the sacraments, this kind of literature? Was it heretical? Not quite. You got that? Not quite. Almost. And where it got over into heresy, Erasmus could pass it off as fiction. Very deadly, by the way. Well, I've already mentioned his work on the Greek text. His Textus Receptus, or received text, was the basis of the King James Version. He elevated reason and exegesis over authority and illumination. Very important. He elevated reason and exegesis over authority and illumination, understanding the scriptures. Nobody else did. Bainton, in his work on Erasmus, wrote this. Bainton's work, Erasmus of Rotterdam. He certainly would not deny the historic revelation, but emphatically he insists that direct revelation has ceased. The Holy Ghost does not sit as a dove on the back of a chair to whisper in anybody's ear, as in the pictures of Gregory the Great. And by the way, look on the front of your syllabus, the cover sheet. That's the picture he's referring to. You see that on the yellow page or the front page? That's the picture of Gregory the Great, and see the dove sitting on it. There was a story went around that a dove representing the Holy Spirit whispered in Gregory's ear, giving him divine revelation, and somebody saw it. That's the man with the stylus and the board, and he saw it and recorded it. Yeah, you got it. So that was the story went around the Middle Ages that Gregory the Great, the Pope, Gregory the Seventh, had this dove whispering in his ear the Holy Spirit, and he said, "The Holy Ghost does not sit as a dove on the back of the chair to whisper in anybody's ear, as in the pictures of Gregory the Great." Now, by the way, in this, listen to me, in that he denied illumination, he elevated direct reason, exegesis, direct literary analysis, he went far beyond Luther or Calvin. You do not find this emphasized again by a religious leader until you come to Alexander Campbell or the Campbell Stone movement. Interestingly enough. You see what in many ways he was more of a Protestant than was either Luther or Calvin. He disagreed with Luther on the question of the freedom of the will. He said that didn't make any sense. It's obviously not true. And as I've already suggested, Luther's great work, Bondage of the Will, you can read that. He says, in which Luther says, the unsaved mind, the alien sinner cannot understand one word of the Bible. Erasmus knew that wasn't true, and that was the great controversy. Summary, Erasmus died in the fold of the Roman Catholic Church, and with the identity, as an enemy of Luther, that is, one of the things that kept him in the church was he was arguing with Luther, and the Pope felt like anybody who didn't like Luther couldn't be all bad. Yet his faith and teaching were infinitely farther removed from Rome and toward the New Testament than were the faith and teaching of Luther. The last statement.